This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Live music in Victoria is in trouble, it seems. If a growing number of music venues can't survive and aren't financially viable, and if music festivals aren't profitable, then where will live music in Victoria live? Where will you be able to see a band or a solo artist, either established or emerging? Will the only gigs be those mega concerts, the Taylor Swifts, the Harry Styles at mega venues? Local musician Cash Savage said yesterday, the musicians are struggling just as much as the venues. She said that the entire live music scene is quickly disappearing in front of our eyes. That's pretty dramatic. Is it true? Next week, the government will open up its 10,000 gigs fund. It was announced just the other day. This will allow venues to apply for grants of up to $10,000 to go towards things like artist fees for live shows between July 1 and 30 next year. So, is that enough? Will that work? And do you care? Does live music need saving? Does live music matter to you? Does it matter to your town, to your suburb, to Victoria's economy? Even if you don't see live music anymore, maybe you never have, do you want it to be saved? What does it bring to you and your local community? Does the future of live music matter?
Here's a song that we'd like to start off with and warm up a little bit here. It was made famous by Chuck Berry.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you, your co-host this morning, Al Newsteed, music reporter at Double J. Al, live music in Victoria, it's almost a rite of passage. I can't imagine my 20s, even my 30s without live music, but more than one third of Australian music festivals are losing money at the moment. They believe it's due to a dwindling younger audience. And this is from a new report that's come out from Creative Australia. On top of that, L music venues are shutting at a rapid rate. The Old Bar in Fitzroy, they've said that they're almost being forced to ask punters to not hold a drink in their hand whilst they're dancing. Otherwise, they can't afford their insurance and they'll have to shut the venue down. What's going on?
Yeah, it's a pretty scary situation for live music in general. And we've seen definitely in the last few months lots of big festival cancellations. But even prior to that, late last year, I did a report with a bunch of colleagues on that small to mid-sized venues were really, really at a crisis point. There was a report late last year that nearly up to 24% of Victoria's live music venues had shut. And really, I think a lot of this has come from COVID. I think most festival organisers will tell you that it's a gamble. Their business is a gamble at the best of times. But, you know, we saw the touring industry just evaporate during COVID. And there's been a lot of musicians, a lot of the industry, everything has really been struggling to kind of prop itself back up. Some of that has been a hangover from COVID. Other parts, it's just a perfect storm of bad circumstances.
So as Cash Savage said, this is not just an issue for the venues and for the festivals. It's an issue for the musicians. Back in the day, you know, back when I was out and out almost 7 days a week, you could see live music anywhere in Victoria. From Ballarat to Bendigo, they had iconic venues. From Hawthorne to Fitzroy to St Kilda, you name it, you could see a band either emerging or established 7 days a week. It's where bands cut their teeth. They maybe had residencies, you name it. How much has the music industry and has just the vibe on the street of being able to experience live music or be in a band changed?
Yeah, it's a huge cultural shift, and it's not just COVID that's prompted that. I think the best way to look at it is that the music industry in general is much more fractured than it used to be. It used to have your kind of dominant forms of sales and exposure. So, you know, you would play gigs, you would sell records, you'd get on telly, you'd get on radio. All of those things are still around, but they're now competing with other forms of promotion and sales. So social media has played a huge part. Music streaming has kind of gutted the conventional record sales and also the value of music in general, I'd argue. So I think really you're looking at a much wider shift of music in general, not just the live music scene. But we're really seeing now, yeah, these crisis points, these pinch points for venues and for festivals, precisely because of those attitudes towards music, towards the value of music, the costs of running it. It's a really complicated issue.
You touched on something interesting there, which is the attitude and the value that we put on music in the music scene in Victoria. So as I said at the beginning, even if you don't go to live music, do you think the average person understands the economic impact and the economic value that music and the arts brings to this state, and without it, the onflow impacts that it could have for small businesses and for towns? We'll go to Trevor in Ararat in just a moment. So, Trev, hang there. But the onflow impacts are huge, aren't they?
They are, yeah. And I would say most people don't understand it. I'm not saying that as like a criticism, but you know, I think particularly in a younger generation, we can get to the report about how a younger audience is buying tickets later or just not buying tickets at all. I think that as well, not being able to go and see gigs when you're 16 to 18 because you're stuck inside because of the virus that shan't be named, that changes your attitude to what kind of music is valued and how you value it. And also, you know, everyone's feeling that right now. The cost of living crisis has all of us looking at what we're spending and being like, is this worth it for me? Is it worth it right now? And, you know, unfortunately, something like music gets to be seen as a luxury rather than a necessity.
Trev's in Ararat. Hi, Trevor.
Hello. How are you today?
Really well, mate. How are you? What did you want to say?
Oh, I was just up the road. I own the road that started the Gold Rush in Ararat. So you drive past my farm to go to the Pitch Festival, which is where the big music festival happens every year. Unfortunately, this year, they had to cancel it a bit early because of the bushfire risk. But I really think that it's like when you go to a supermarket and you're having a bit of a downer day and someone's playing some lovely saxophone or some nice acoustic guitar, you throw a couple of bucks in the container and it's just lifted your whole mood. I think for a lot of people being able to come to rural Victoria to see a music festival, it gets them out of the city, it puts them in nature. When people come here, it's not just bringing a couple of dollars to town, but it's bringing people to the wild. Like, it's taking people where they can go camping, sit by a river, sit around a campfire, watch a sunrise, watch a sunset, watch a moon rise, watch the shooting stars. All the things that people in cities miss out on that primarily we're hardwired to need, want and desire.
And I think, though, a lot of that is because people can't afford it. Those texts just flooding in. One here, it says, I've got teenagers who love seeing live music. There's next to nothing under $400 and still struggle to get tickets. They sell out so fast. I remember seeing big Australian bands for free or cheap at the Maya Music Bowl or at Kooyong, etc. Where is this stuff? The St Kilda outdoor venues is good as well, maybe the Palace. Why not have more of these? When we talk about the role of the government, Al, is it about ensuring that there are more free and big, cheap events so that you're not having to fork out $400 for a ticket or for 3 days?
Yeah, I think it definitely helps, you know, and there are, you know, free events. Something like St Kilda Festival comes to mind, an annual festival, and that's just gotten bigger and bigger over the years. But I think also the way I've been describing it is there's kind of a feast or famine happening at the moment where we do see these monstrous tours from Taylor Swift and Pink that are selling blockbuster numbers and bringing blockbuster figures. And then we're seeing local venues are struggling to pay their bar staff. So I think, basically all small to mid-sized venues and festivals are calling for government support because they need that to just kind of get through this particular period, the post-COVID period, when they need propping up again.
Gary's in Langwarrin. Gary? Morning.
Morning. Southeastern suburbs, when I was growing up, there was pubs with bands everywhere, Dingley, Morty Alec, Moorabbin, but they all left, put pokies in there. That's what happened. The pokie venues just took over.
Yeah. And I said that to you, Al, you know, once. It didn't matter what suburb you were in, even relatively sort of, you know, quite conventional suburbs like Hawthorne, there were gigs. What role has pokies played in shutting down some of these opportunities?
Probably not just pokies. I mean, you're looking at in sort of the gentrification of a lot of suburbs, you know, a lot of areas that traditionally, even 10 years ago, there was a lot of venues that were being shut down due to noise complaints, and we saw protections eventually come around, but there was venues that fell victim to that are no longer around. So, yeah, the definitely commercial enterprises like pokies would muscle out venues that aren't earning as much, but I think there's lots of those situations where small to mid-sized venues are really struggling to kind of, yeah, pay staff, pay the rent and get people through the door.
This, punters at venues need to be prepared to pay what gigs are worth. Entry prices have barely gone up since the 80s. Venues should look at changing the business model to not rely on booze to make a profit. Government also need to enforce regulations on venues when they award grants so that the artists are paid properly. Festivals should adjust the model to adapt the cost of living pressures, use grants to share money across the whole lineup rather than just millions on that one headliner, and also focus more on local acts. That's from Nicole, who says she's a band member and a punter.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. This is The Conversation Hour. I don't want another
lover. So does live music need saving in Victoria? Are the government grants enough, or do we need bigger reform? Gail in Bendigo says, we just attended the 50th anniversary of the Sunbury Festival. Tickets were $30, 4,000 attended. It was amazing. We'll talk about that a little later. Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you. Elle Newsteed is your co-host this morning, music reporter from Double J. Whether it be venues or festivals, they all sort of seem to be struggling at the moment. Jaden Bath is from the Lockhart Festival. Jaden, I was actually really touched and quite impressed. I mean, you launched back in 2018, your festival, but just recently you penned an open letter on your website that said exactly why you're potentially struggling and why people what people need to understand about how festivals are feeling at the moment. Why did you write that letter?
Hey, basically to just tell it how it is. I think that there's an ongoing pressure to always be seen as successful and selling out early and the demand being huge. But I just think people need to be realistic with how they approach things, and we receive really good community response from that openness.
Yeah, Jaden, I really appreciated the candidness of your blog post as well. Did you feel compelled to do that because you feel most people just don't understand what it takes to put on a music festival, the financial pressures?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we were genuinely just looking at cancelling our festival because we were just suffering so much from a financial point of view. And I thought, well, I've dedicated 5 years of my life to this. I think it's time that we just call for help and pretty much just say to people, we can't run unless people commit early. And these are the reasons why. This is the financial pressures that a festival faces in preparing to run. And I think because we're small and community orientated, people really understood and bought in.
Tell us a little bit about the festival and where it's positioned and how community orientated it is.
Yeah, so it's on the Great Ocean Road in a place called Princetown, which is 10 minutes from Port Campbell and the 12 Apostles. I started the festival in 2018. I'm from Colac, so an hour up the road from there. It's me and the farmer who run it, so it's completely independent. It's literally just us two that own, run it, and everyone who works on it is local or one of our friends or some connection that we've made along the way. We book local bands every year. We also scout who we think the best and emerging acts are across Australia and bring them to Princetown. And then we also do things like live art, storytelling. We have a whole comedy hour, local food trucks. It's been quite successful.
So are you worried about the future of this festival? You spoke before about how much this potentially could cost you. What? I mean, you don't have to tell us exact numbers if you don't want to, but what sort of figures are we talking about here? Like, how much money could you potentially lose?
Yeah, I don't mind, to be honest, because you can do basic maths on it. Our tickets last year were $200 and our break even was approximately 1,000 people. So it was a $200,000 break even. And then you can just reverse it from there. So if you're only selling, say, 500 tickets, then you're looking down at a $100,000 loss. And these obviously quite substantial numbers. They are for me. You know, we're quite different to one of the huge multinational promoters. We're, as I said, just two people who organized an event in regional Vic. So getting the early buy-in is what's critical. It's not necessarily a cash flow thing. It's just having people commit to the date and knowing that they're going to come, but there really is this last minute ticket buying behaviour that's causing the headaches for all festivals at the moment.
And Jaden, that seems to be consistent from the report we've seen from Creative Australia recently as well. What about the audience demographic? Are you noticing a drop-off in younger audiences?
It's difficult to say. I'd say our most recent one actually was the most age-varied we've ever had. There was probably as many children as there was over 60-year-olds, and we just had everyone in between, which was really good. And I think something we want to strive more to have age diversity and not just focus on one age bracket, because I think what you're just referring to, Al, was definitely what the bigger festivals like Splendor and Grooven may have just suffered from. Mm. Like, they're traditionally chasing the 18 to 24-year-old audience who aren't there at the moment. So the further you can spread that, the less risk.
I mean, Al, is this something, I mean, Jaden, you know, you mentioned there they're sort of the big promoters, and we know we've got big international backers on some of the really big events. But it feels like anyone and everyone is facing the potential of shutting down. It doesn't, like, these are big festivals and small festivals like Jaden's. Is everyone potentially at risk?
I think seeing those bigger events fall over, that's the impression it feels like. But that's why, again, I say feast or famine, because I think there's probably a lot of examples of festivals that are really excelling. And if we see something like Splendor not going ahead, there's all of a sudden that, oh, the entire scene is in doom and gloom, and we're actually seeing pockets that are successful and they are facing the same challenges, but they're adapting to them better, is what I've seen and from speaking to people. But Jaden, I think what's interesting that you raise as well is what do you actually want to see? Because, you know, as you've noted, you've been up some years, you've been down some years, pre-COVID, post-COVID, et cetera. What do you want to actually see in this current climate?
Honestly, just people committing and buying early. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think as a small independent event, we just pretty much say it how it is.
Jaden, thanks so much. We hope that it really goes well for you and that it's something that not only yourself but the farmer and the local community can continue to run. That's Jaden Barth there from the Lockhart Festival. So many texts on this, Al. I don't even know where to begin. But this is an interesting one, though. It says, this whole discussion is actually framed around rock music. There's a big wide world of music in Victoria, including jazz and experimental, contemporary, classical, etc., which all needs support to thrive. These rock festivals that spend a fortune on headlines acts, can't make it work, and now they're sucking up all the money in this state. I'm not saying they don't deserve the support, but the idea of being funded needs to sort of broaden out. Is this across the board? I mean, when we're talking about festivals, we saw the Wangaratta Jazz Festival, for example, after decades shut down. So I don't think it's just rock music.
No, it's not. I think what I've been seeing is that genre specific or cultural specific events are doing really well. Just recently, something like the Sold Out Festival, which focuses on R&B and soul. There's electronic music festivals that have been doing really well. Pitch, that was mentioned before, is a great example. Although then you've got the factor of extreme weather meant to its cancellation. So no, we're not just talking about rock music, and it's not just the rock festivals that are suffering. But yeah, again, I just keep bringing it up, that feast or famine, this idea that, you know, some things are doing really, really well, others aren't doing well. But I think across the board, there's this huge combination of challenges that everyone is facing and either adapting to or hitting a brick wall against.
Rowan's in Toora. Hi, Rowan.
How you doing?
Really well, mate. What do you want to say?
Well, I'm harking back to the good old days of the 70s. Now, when you see a gig for $20 a night or something, at least you go to Geelong, because I lived in Werribee, and you go to Eureka and you'd see Goodbye Tiger from album being promoted by Richard Clapton and the Sports and a little quirky band called the Red Hot Peppers, not the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Red Hot Peppers.
I guess just so much has changed now, Rowan. I mean, I guess maybe public liability, insurance, climate change, all of those things that maybe in the 70s we just weren't considering as much. Lee is in Bundoora.
Hi, how are you going?
Really well. What do you want to share?
I think my greatest memories of growing up were seeing live music, going to festivals, and most of my friends now I met at festivals. People will say to me, how do you know these people? Oh, that's just a random I met at Meredith, or that's someone I met at Golden Plains. So to me, hearing that live music is dying is just devastating.
What does it mean for the community? So let's say someone hasn't been to a music festival, they maybe don't see live gigs, doesn't really interest them. Does it impact everyone, do you think, Leah?
Yeah, I think so. Especially going to Meredith and Golden Plains, that's also in Meredith in Victoria, it affects their whole community. They have a community tucker tent, they call, and they cook the barbecue and the funds go back into the community. But also the people that go to see these bands, there might be bands you've never heard of, and that's good for the bands and for the people, because then they gain a following and the people will have a new band to follow. I think it's wide-ranging, the people this affects.
Good to hear from you. Al, when we're talking about people being able to afford tickets and go to things, I mean, I raise Taylor Swift here, and the amount of money that people spent on tickets, the amount of money that was apparently generated for the entire country.
Mm. Millions.
Are we? And then some, right?
Yeah.
And it was an incredible. My husband and daughter went, and my husband said, you know, this was the most incredible experience of his life because of what he witnessed and how young women, how they treated each other and how great it was. So I'm not saying it wasn't a great event.
Mm.
But are we at risk of those only being the safe gigs, the profitable gigs, those mega artists and the mega venues, seeing a band at the MCG as opposed to some dingy little pub?
Well, the easiest way to look at it, again, is just the maths. If you're spending $400 up to $1,000 in some cases on tickets for Taylor Swift, that's money that's not going elsewhere. And that's a choice, probably a difficult choice a lot of those people made in a cost of living crisis. But yeah, again, speaking to festivals and venues, a lot of them would bring up Taylor unprompted as an example, because it's a big international blockbuster act. There's a lot of a focus, there's a lot of media attention on that, and all of that is actually starving, you know, attention from what is happening locally. Another good example is Fred Again, who's like a British electronic producer. He was here for Laneway Festival last year, which obviously would have been a huge boon for them. He was out here earlier this year on a headline tour that he literally announced just impromptu while he was in the country, had demand for millions of tickets, created this huge frenzy, but then all of a sudden, all of that attention and energy doesn't necessarily translate to what's happening for the local Australian music scene. So it's a complicated issue, and I think, you know, there's probably a risk that that could happen, but, you know, we've always had big blockbuster tours come through, yeah. and that. I think the difference now is that we're seeing that because the local scene is struggling, it does actually need some more of that attention. You know, we've got lots of texts here of people saying, like, it's not just blockbuster tours. I can go every weekend and see a show for $40 to $80. And it's like, that's great, but who's doing that, you know, in the broader
scheme?
And the
other thing is, with festivals, and let's say there is a big blockbuster headliner, they would often then go on and do tours around the country and to regional areas. It's not just that festival. They would go on to do additional shows. So the cancellation then runs deep into other venues who have maybe stumped up some money, or maybe you've got accommodation or restaurants or whoever that are relying on them going to Castlemaine. So it's not just the festival, it's those additional shows as well.
It is. I think in some of those bigger cases, you know, using Splendour as an example, they wouldn't actually go regionally. There'd be lots of paperwork in terms of, you know,
they said that they couldn't.
Well, either that they're exclusive to the festival or that they only also play, you know, capital cities. Secret Sounds, who are the company behind Splendour, they typically also present the sideshow tours for those. So I don't know if the knock-on effect is necessarily in that instance. It's more just that, you know, particularly for a younger audience, if they have X amount of dollars to spend, are they going to wait and see Taylor Swift, who they've been waiting to see for 5 years, or they'll think, oh, I can just go to Splendour next year when it's on again, and all of a sudden it isn't.
Kate's in the Grampians. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
What did you want to say?
Oh, I'm one of the festival co-directors for the Grampians Grab Escape Festival to be held in a few weeks, and sort of mimicking what Jaden was saying before about, just the need for ticket holders to book early and secure so that there's confidence for event managers to be able to put on such community and regional events.
It's so double-edged, isn't it? Because you've got cost of living, people thinking, okay, if I can afford to buy this ticket that was maybe a couple of $100s, what if the festival doesn't go ahead? You need people to buy the tickets so that it does go ahead, but then people are scared to buy the tickets, Kate, because they're not sure if it's going to go ahead. Like, so who makes each other feel comfortable in that situation?
I know, it's certainly the double-edged sword, and we obviously, these events take, you know, year on year. We've been going for 31 years, so we kick off planning after in May each year after the last one. So we're definitely all systems go, and there wouldn't be a reason why we wouldn't go ahead. But it may start to look a little different, and the strategy behind what we can offer. We, when we're talking about the music, we have over 17 bands, and most of those are original across our three-day festival, and we really try and support our local artists and then those who are up and coming to get them out on the scene. And for people to hear people that they often wouldn't get to see.
Kate, good to hear from you. There's a text here that says, is this actually a worldwide issue or is it just in Australia? That's from Katie. Al Newstead, as music reporter for Double J, are we alone in this issue?
I don't think we are. I think we're experiencing it maybe more amplified in some way because it's Australia traditionally a big landmass, small population. So it's harder to sustain a musician's career than it is, say, Europe, where you can just kind of bump from venue to venue each night. But yes, it's definitely happening overseas. I think it was really interesting seeing events like Coachella, which just happened this past weekend, and Glastonbury, which is coming up in June. Even the response to those lineups, you had a lot of people on social media being like, eh, this isn't great, used to be better, etc. There's this real kind of, you know, apathy and kind of despondence around what's available and what people are expected. And then even then here in Australia, you've got a younger audience who are used to seeing these kinds of mammoth blockbuster bills overseas. And then when they see what's being offered locally, they think, oh, why isn't it as big as that? Without considering the idea that to put something on like that costs a lot. And in a lot of instances, festivals are doing more than a good job in putting together what they can on the current finances and conditions.
So the report that we've just had and the money that the government is offering, is that enough? If live music needs saving from venues to festivals, what needs to change?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Al Newstead from Double J, music reporter there, looking at the future of music venues and music festivals in Victoria. What do we stand to lose if they are shutting down at a rapid rate? Simone Schinkel is the CEO of Music Victoria. A lot of work and research has for years now, Simone, been going into the future of Victorian and Australian music. The government has offered grants, I think around $10,000 for grants to go towards being able to put on events and to pay for artists. Is it enough?
Look, I think this is some really welcome short-term relief, but fundamentally we have some really big systemic issues, as others have mentioned. We're finding ourselves in a perfect storm. The costs have risen of doing all of our events, and people have no money to spend. In addition, changing consumer habits are happening so quickly that businesses don't actually have enough time to evolve and respond to those changes and adapt quickly enough. We're constantly looking for solutions and ideas, and we have actually met with festivals and venue operators just yesterday as part of some industry consultation we're doing across the next 2 weeks to really figure out what will help and where we need to make those changes. It's a $2.55 billion economic contribution that live music makes to this state. So it's worth figuring out how we can make it work.
Yeah, that's great, Simone. One point I'd really like you to speak to as well is, you know, we were talking before about people don't quite understand the economic benefits that live music can bring to the state. Do you have any kind of figures, or can you speak to that in terms of, you know, the economic gains that the state can see from supporting and investing in live music?
Yeah, well, look, everything that flows from it. So as I mentioned just before, it's a $2.55 billion economic contribution. So that's about the ticket sales, the pubs, beer sales, the accommodation that happens when you travel. It's really a circular and an ecology that we're keeping alive and keeping working. We've got crew, we've got toilet providers, we've got fencing providers, security, as well as our musicians and, you know, some of the straightforward things that we think about when putting on events. There's just so many connected parts that we don't want to overlook because so many people are employed by this industry.
The red tape that's now involved in either putting on a festival or running a music venue. Now, we want fundamentally people to be safe, so this is not about cutting corners in any way. But when you've got music venues saying, well, look, I'm either have to shut down or you're not allowed to take a drink onto the dance floor because I can't afford my public liability and my insurance if you hold a drink on the dance floor and something happens. Yep, we've been doing that for decades. Has it the red tape just got too tight?
Insurance is just a nightmare at the moment, particularly because we don't have a specific insurance policy that is fit for purpose for live music venues. We're being treated as pubs or hotels, and we're neither. And so the requirements that come, I know one small venue is on a very similar license to that of Crown Casino. And I'm like, they're completely different businesses, but that's built the way the insurance
so is that the change the government needs to make? A lot of people have been saying, look, the grants are great, won't say no, thank you, never say no to money. But fundamentally what we need is changes to insurance, changes to tax. The Band-Aid solutions are great to stop the bleeding for a short period of time, but if you want real change, then we need real change.
Yeah, absolutely. We need real change. But I think also the real change is the stuff that takes a long time to make happen just by the nature of how it's structured. So that work has all been in process, particularly around insurance, for at least 3 years that I know of. But it's still not getting any easier to make that case or to get the changes we need to take effect.
So, Maureen, are you confident that the industry will recover? It felt like the music industry took one of the biggest hits, hospitality in general, but with COVID and the recovery from the lockdowns and the pandemic, it sort of feels like the music industry really took the brunt of it.
Well, there's that common phrase, the first to fall down and the last to come back, that was used a lot, particularly. Would you say, Simone?
Yeah, definitely. I believe in music. That's why I do this job and why everyone who works in the industry is in the industry.
Amen.
We know there's a reason why we do it, and that is the joy it brings us, the community building capacity of it, the fact that we can escape, you know, whatever might be going on. And I think these things will triumph. So I haven't given up all hope. But I think there's a significant change that we're going through right now, that what we've always done is no longer working or going to work. We can make as many changes as possible, but we also need to evolve and respond to consumer demands. I mean, the ticket sales and buying late, how do we make that work? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. But can I play devil's advocate? We're going to have a chat to Tony Wright in just a moment from The Age, who went back to Sunbury on the weekend, and lots of people have been talking about 50 years of Sunbury. And that, I guess, comparison between the old days and the festivals and why do they work then and not now, there were less festivals. Are there just too many festivals now? Like, is that part of the problem? Yes, they're great in their niche and every little town's got one, but is that part of the problem?
That's not the first thing that comes to mind, because actually if you've got the community there to back it, there's often been communities that haven't been served by festivals or venues in the past. So actually the number is supportable when we all have the money to spend in the first place. But I think that's what we're at risk of losing as well, is that we'll lose those that really cater to a subculture or a minority groups, and they'll disappear or it'll go underground and it'll be so hard to find. But yeah.
Simone, thank you. Thanks so much. Simone Schinkel there, the CEO of Music Victoria. Al Newstead is with you, music reporter for Double J. There has been lots of comparisons, right, back to the 70s, and they were cheaper, the festival still ran, it was simpler. I'm not sure how much we can make that comparison, because maybe times were different. Tony Wright might know. He's the associate editor, special writer for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. And you relived a little bit of your youth just recently, Tony. 50 years, Australia's Woodstock, it was known as Sunbury. It held, I guess, part two of that. Were things simpler in the 70s when it comes to putting on a festival? And why is it harder now, do you think?
Well, you've heard quite a few of the explanations there. Insurance, COVID, reluctance of people to spend a lot of money early to get tickets just in case things don't go as planned and so forth. Back then, of course, as you said, there weren't very many festivals around. There had been a few. Most of them were failures financially. But Sunbury 72, which was 52 years ago, and which I attended, was one of those cries to an emerging youth. And we were emerging. I was 19, and all my mates were, of course. And we had gone through that period where people were being drafted for Vietnam, and nobody was quite sure where the future was. And the other thing, of course, is that Australia didn't really celebrate the 60s in the 60s. It was in the 70s. So when 72 came along, and it was incredibly well promoted. Everyone knew about it and so forth. I was just a cadet journalist way out in the bush in Portland, Victoria, and I just had to go. And I think that was what the feeling was for a lot of people. Instead of, you know, going to a giant anti-Vietnam protest, you could go to a rock and roll festival and have a good time.
But this is, Al, like what you were talking about, that rite of passage potentially, that an entire generation is losing by not having that festival moment, even if it's just one. You have that one Sunbury.
Yeah, I think, Tony, as well, you probably agree that we don't really have a monoculture the way that we used to. There's so many kind of, music and all kinds of entertainment cultures are really fractured now. You have people that can cater their very specific needs, whether that's online or in broadcast. And, times have changed a lot, but I think that appeal of the rite of passage is still there. It's just that, you know, a younger generation who've maybe gone through COVID haven't experienced what you've experienced, where you're standing in a cultural moment with a lot of peers.
Naked, muddy people.
You're quite right, Al. I mean, it was a monoculture. We were brought up on albums. You know, if you wanted to listen to music, you went and got an album, and everyone got the same album. And so we knew what our music was. It was, you know, one thing. It was rock and roll. It was lots of different parts of it and so forth. But now you have, as you say, quite a fractured culture, and lots of people seeking different experiences and different things. I mean, you know, for me, it was just, in fact, I didn't even pay to go.
Admit that now, yeah.
$6 for 3 days. And I rang up 3UZ and they said, oh, yeah, we'll give you a press pass. No worries, mate. And off I went. There were no rules.
Going back to Sunbury, Tony? Was it, were you reliving your youth? Was it the part two? What was it like?
Look, it was frankly hilarious. Really, I mean, those had been to the first Sunbury's at my age, you know, you see yourself as forever 19 or 25 or something or other, and you look around and as I mentioned in the article, most of the crowd could have come from the local lawn bowls club, you know. But everyone did have a good time. And the thing about it was, and back to monoculture, I suppose, is the bands that played there played the music from that time, and they were tight as all hell. You know, most of these guys who had played way back then are way in their 70s. And here they are
still
producing music without any change. You know, it was extraordinary.
And
really,
there were people that were known for the festival circuit. You know, I think Billy Thorpe has actually got a plaque, you know, somewhere near Sunbury, and just being known for that. Thanks so much for your time, Tony. We're glad you had a good time at Sunbury. Both times. Good on you. The associate editor and special writer for The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. Although there's a text here that says, Al, I don't think the artist actually got paid at Sunbury. It was different times.
Which is probably why it stopped after a few years, potentially. But, you know, it's cultural impact. You can't put a price on that. You know, it's still fondly remembered and regarded 50 years later. And I think that's
Do you have one? Is there one? I mean, mine's my first big day out, which I think was the first big day out.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, thinking, oh my God, look at all these people, my tribe, music that I've been listening to on CD now in front of me. It kind of changed my life a little bit.
Yeah, it does. And I think every generation does have that element. For me, I was in the big day out generation as well. I think Leah before mentioned Meredith Music Festival. That's one I hold dear to my heart. And I think in those instances, it is, just as Tony talked about, it's this idea of finding your people, of everyone experiencing and enjoying something at the same time. I mean, that's the whole point of live music, right? The COVID taught us that. You cannot replace the feeling of being in a room, enjoying something together, singing along, sometimes with strangers, sometimes with your best mates. That's the feeling that everyone is chasing. That's why people will put mortgages on their houses for a third time to put on festivals, is so that we can have that experience. It's priceless.
Well, they're priceless, but they're being impacted on everything from insurance to weather events. And this is the reason why we're seeing so many of them be cancelled, or people that are crossing everything hoping that it can go ahead. Millard Hagani is a Senior Lecturer of Urban Mobility, Public Safety and Disaster Risk at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Is it just getting too hard when we look at all the different ways that festivals can be affected, from climate change to insurance, Millard? Is it pretty obvious to you as to why they're dropping like flies?
Good day, Richelle, and thank you for having me today. It's not very obvious to me, but one thing is very clear, and that is the fact that, and one factor that is contributing to this effect is uncertainties that are created as a result of climate impacts and severe weather conditions that we see more frequently affecting these festivals. Essentially, organizing a festival relies on planning in advance, and the consumer also requires some planning in advance. And that does not go hand in hand with uncertainty.
But things change. Like, we're talking about Sunbury, right? So Sunbury was rained out and was muddy. There's incredible photographs of, you know, people just covered head to toe in mud. But if that was now, it wouldn't go ahead. Yes, Sunbury ended up folding and wasn't successful in the end. But Millard, I guess now, once upon a time, the festival just would have ran, and now it's too risky for people to go ahead.
Yes. Well, our risk tolerance might have changed, and also the severity of these weather-related incidents might have also changed. We have seen incidents around the world, not just in Australia, where the festival had to cancel midway. We have seen venues had to evacuate, and concerts and shows have to finish halfway through. So, once upon a time, this might have been an acceptable risk, but I think given the current condition, this may be one of the biggest threats to our
Is that something you've seen, Al, that the festivals, it's weather on top of everything else?
Yeah, I think, like Millard's saying, it's definitely, we've seen the changes and a combination of being risk adverse. Also, insurance policies have gone up in a crazy amount in response to that. You know, I think there was in the report someone saying that for public liability insurance for music venues, it's gone tenfold, from like $20,000 per year to as much as $120,000. So that's obviously going to have a squeeze. But I think also, you know, it goes back to that combination element, you know, that we are seeing more events cancel or postpone because of weather conditions. And then that puts the squeeze on finances, what's going to happen for the next year, that kind of, that element.
So, Millard, what can festivals do? If, like, you know, Jaden, who we spoke to before from Lockhart, there's only so much long-range weather forecasting you can get. The Bureau, you know, can only tell us so much.
Exactly.
What can festivals do to try and, you know, be as safe and secure as possible?
It's very hard. There are not too many options available. When one option would be to move away from regional areas, but that defeats the purpose of having these festivals in beloved regional areas that brings cultural tourism and all the economic benefits. So that defeats the purpose, essentially. Another thing would be to learn how to adapt to these climate risks in order, and do better risk assessment. Of course, it's easy to say, but you know, we need to learn how to live with this risk, essentially. So what I have been advocating is that sometimes these festivals can go ahead, for example, in a heat condition, and it might not be safe for certain people, it might be safe for other people. So it could be that one prescription for everybody may not work, and we may start engaging people in this risk assessment and let them make informed decisions, for example, that this heat wave is hitting the festival, but these the people who have certain health conditions might be impacted. Other people might be fine.
Yeah, Millard, good to speak with you again. Thank you. Millard Hagani, Senior Lecturer of Urban Mobility, Public Safety and Disaster Risk at the University of New South Wales. There was a text before and it was talking actually about the Menin Garlic Festival, right? So not even about a music festival. But the text, and I can't fact check this at the moment, but they've said that they can't run this year because they don't have enough volunteers. Volunteers for music festivals, they kind of rely on volunteers as well. Does that come into this huge, great, sort of perfect storm that we're looking at the moment?
I feel like it's definitely another factor, but, you know, as Simone mentioned earlier, I don't know if it's the first thing that leaps to mind. I don't necessarily, again, can't fact check this, but I don't think there's like a vast drought in volunteers. I think it's just kind of another complication that's part of it. Definitely in, I'd say, regional and community-centred festivals, they would have much more of an impact.
Dr. Catherine Strong is an associate professor in the music industry program at RMIT. Catherine, I guess for years now you've been looking at the future and the feasibility of Australian and in particular Victorian music. We've seen the new report come out from Creative Australia. We've seen the grants be brought forward from the government. How are you feeling about the current state of music in Victoria at the moment?
I think there's a lot of really good questions being asked, I think, in response to what we've seen happening. I think, you know, music is one of those things that's always going to happen. Yeah, so music is fine. It's the sort of commercial processes that are surrounding music and the way we think about the value of music and then these questions that we're asking ourselves about who is responsible for looking after the health of music. That are starting to really be brought to the forefront in a way that is actually really healthy, I think, for us to be talking about some of these things. I think the fact that we're seeing some really great new research come out, like the Creative Australia report that you just referred to, is giving us some like absolutely incredible information to help us make decisions. But the other bit of research that's just come out in the last few days has been coming through The Guardian, and they've been talking about like looking at grants for big festivals and asking some really good questions as well about who is that grant money going to? And, you know, in particular, should taxpayers be putting a whole bunch of money into big festivals that are essentially under the ownership of multi-million dollar corporations as well? So definitely, like, I'm never going to say that we shouldn't be putting taxpayer money into things like festivals and looking after music, but I think like asking some really like fine-grained questions about exactly where that money is going is something that it's good to see happening.
Yeah, I read the same report, Catherine, that you're referring to. And it's interesting because I think really from the government perspective, you know, as we have before from Music Victoria, they see it as a net benefit, this idea of, okay, if we invest a few million dollars into a festival, we're going to see that return into the local economy. But, yeah, that report in particular was asking questions around Splendour in the Grass and where some of that funding might go, who actually benefits, et cetera. But that's kind of dealing with a big commercial sector, and we're obviously dealing with also smaller events and smaller festivals. I guess to pivot a little bit, though, what were some of the other takeaways from the Creative Australia report that stood out to you compared to what you've been seeing over the past few years?
I think that it's really good that they're saying that the situation, if you look at this report, is not quite as dire as some of the discussion that we've been having, I think, in the last couple of months. Obviously, the data for this report was collected before the last few months, where we've been seeing like a number of like very high profile festivals pulling out or cancelling or downsizing, but still, like, the picture that it paints is of a relatively healthy sort of sector, and I think that is the case overall. Like, if they're talking about 535 music festivals, we've seen a handful of them have to change what they're doing or not go ahead this year, but that still leaves a lot of festivals. So things are not like a complete disaster area out there. But, you know, I think pulling apart like who it is who's had to cancel, like the exact reasons why, and then thinking about what we can do to make sure that we don't see sort of a flow-on effect, either in terms of like people just not having confidence to buy tickets or to go ahead with their events, and also just like trying to get on top of those factors that are causing the festivals to have to pull the plug.
Just finally and quickly, Catherine, I wonder, and there's a lot of similarities here to a show I just did recently on hospitality and the sort of issues that they're facing, whether it be in Metro Melbourne or regional Victoria, and how they feel like they just need greater support and that the reaction has been too slow, that the writing has been on the wall, the calls for help have been there for a very long time. Do you feel like now the help is coming but too little too late?
Look, I think that we're still seeing the fallout of COVID to some extent. Like there's still sort of this uncertainty around, like, there was these horrible couple of years where everything completely went to pieces, and then those pieces are still being put back together in some ways. I think one of the really good things that did come out of COVID, I mean, it feels weird to even say that, but was just the way that people did focus attention on the sort of conditions of music work as a whole, and did sort of put the focus on how, as you say, for a long time, people have been saying, look, there are big problems in this sector. There's a lot of exploitation. There's a lot of people being asked to work under conditions that are, you know, really not ideal.
I know you could say that across everything, though, from cleaning to hospitality, the spotlight was put on. But I totally agree. And look, your research is vital. Catherine, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Catherine Strong, there, Associate Professor in the Music Industry Program at RMIT. Just finally, Al Newstead, as a music reporter for Double J, you know, there were moments during the lockdowns where it felt like we were living real life Kevin Bacon Footloose, you know, where there was a ban on dancing. You know, the music industry really copped it. Is it bouncing back? Like, do you feel optimism there generally?
It's a tough one to answer. Like, as we've discussed the past hour, it feels like it's not back to form. It feels like it's hobbling back, if anything. But I'm also optimistic. And another way to look at it is that this isn't an industry in crisis, but an industry that's undergoing a major shift. You know, as was said earlier, music's not going anywhere. Live music's not going anywhere. But I think the way that we get it, the way we celebrate it, the way it's attended and presented, we're probably seeing a major shift to some new format. That's one way to look at it that I think is much more optimistic than saying that we're no longer going to see festivals. That's it.
I'm so glad that you're optimistic because it shapes your life, right? It really does. And it's too important. It's too valuable, not just for our souls and our well-being, but actually the mathematics. It's important for our economy as well. Al, thanks so much. We come back another time and hang out.
We'll make the time. Yeah, thanks for having me, Rochelle.
Al Newstead there, music reporter from Double J. Take care. Speak tomorrow.